Hello and welcome to IT Conversations. I'm your host, Doug Kay, and today I'm excited to bring you another recorded session from the Web 2.0 conference held in San Francisco, California, October 5th through 7th, 2004. The following presentation is a panel discussion entitled The Mobile Platform. We received this recording only in part, and we join it now in progress.
Trip Hawkins, you had an article just recently in the US Today where you talked about everyone's carrying a little computer, right? And they just don't know it. And I think that the most important thing about that little computer is it's a connected computer, right? And so we're going to start using that for a lot more. We're going to be able to start seeing a lot more interaction with people using that little computer in their pocket, their mobile phone. And that's where we're going to see a lot more of demand and killer apps.
It's interesting because I think that to a certain degree the PDA has killed expectation for people as well. I mean, the PDA was the most unconnected thing you had in your pocket for the longest time, and that is changing over time now, and indeed we're turning some smartphones into the PDA just as the PDA is sort of dipping down. But definitely you have these divergent markets based upon devices people carry. I mean, we're just talking about this, even the difference between having a BlackBerry or a Sidekick, it's a completely different market, completely different expectations. Jory, I know you've realigned expectations, or are expecting to realign expectations again. Why don't you tell us a little bit about where you're headed?
Well, so our belief is that there's going to be two devices. So kind of from the hardware side, that there's going to be a phone and a computer. And which functionality rolls in to either of those, I think ultimately all the other appliance devices, whether it's a BlackBerry device or an iPod or a PDA, the functionality of that's going to fold one way or the other depending on what's appropriate. And so from our end, we've been developing just, you know, the pocketable full Windows computer so that you don't have to make the kind of compromises. And when you talk about accessing the web, you're talking about accessing all of the web with all of the applications you want, and you can just choose it, and it's not a purpose-built appliance. And even now in some of the initial discussion about there's going to be this highly segmented, niche-like market, I'm not sure if it really sounds like the web, because it sounds like it's startups who have to do big deals with carriers in order to access a whole variety of proprietary platforms that there's no real standardization on. So I'm not sure if that's really the web, although I do think that there's a lot of important applications, whether it's email or social gaming or chat or whatever it is, that will work perfectly well on a wide variety of phones. And, you know, but if you want to just use all the plugins and, you know, have the experience of however many bazillion web pages are out there now that are made by not just a handful of startups in the Bay Area, then you have to have something more like what people traditionally have called a computer.
Yeah, I think that's important. The majority of the internet data right now is in web form, and we're going to have to interact with that web form as we use our mobile phones. I mean, I have a mobile phone here, and this is something you buy in the U.S. It's an edge data phone, so it gets about 90 kilobits a second for those, it's about 4 or 5K a second. And I access my email, I access the web using the Opera web browser. I can sort of interact with my server. I have a web log, so I maintain my server while I'm away from my PC. I do basically just about everything I can do with a PC using this, you know, this advanced mobile phone. Now, this is not something that everybody's going to have, right? But it's something that's going to happen. And I think that in order to take advantage of the data services that are out there now, that's, you know, rich data services, eBay and Amazon, that we're going to have to find some way of interacting with that web data on the mobile.
Oh, definitely interacting with the web data. So you're using your phone as more of an adjunct of the web, bringing a little bit of web with you, and an adjunct of what you do. You mentioned something about the carriers. I know Trip has been rather successful in getting his software out via the carriers. Some people see the carrier as a barrier, as very much like the old walled garden approach in the early days of the internet. And some see as, you know, there are ways to route around that. There are interesting SMS apps like Dodgeball that say, you know, you give us a network heart. Beat, we don't really need to deal with you anymore. How's your experience been with the carriers, and do they get the web coming to the phone, or you know, what's your opinion in general about the interaction of the phone and the web in the ways it's described?
I think the carriers have been through a lot of growing pains over the last few years, and of course the voice business still dominates their thinking. I think the CTIA said that last year in the U.S. alone, there was $85 billion in voice revenue, but only $2 billion in everything else. But clearly what's happening is that the mobile phone is turning into a social computer. And the reason people carry these computers is to be socially connected. In modern society, we have dismantled the traditional human village. So people, of course, turn to the mobile phone because they want to be connected through voice calls. But the success of SMS, ringtones, camera phones, those are all examples of forms of personal expression and fashion identity and new ways of connecting with your virtual village. So that's kind of a foundation of where I think it needs to go. And right now, again, with the carriers, they are still focused on the voice business. And you can think of this almost like a gas station that sells gas, but then they have a convenience store. And you can go in the convenience store, you can get a bag of pretzels or a candy bar or a soda. And what they haven't quite completely grasped is that that's the tail that's going to wag the dog. It's going to define their brand relation with the customer. It's going to turn into a wireless Walmart. And there's no limit to what they can give their customers in terms of choice and variety and experience. But you have to then realize, well, how does that experience need to be different? I mean, clearly, the vast majority of humanity wants to carry a device about this size. They don't want to carry something much bigger. Obviously, with Moore's law, technology will get more miniaturized. But if it's going to be this small, it means the screen size is going to really prevent it from being used like a PC. In other words, you're not going to browse, you're not going to surf the web with a device like this. I would sort of divide this idea of the social computer into these sort of two halves. On the entertainment side, it's social gaming, where it is a network experience, and you're part of a social community. And we've had a lot of success with that idea already. And we're drawing very heavily on successful social community environments on the internet, such as Neopets and fantasy sports. And I think that informs the direction of what's going to happen with mobile entertainment. Meanwhile, on the other half of the applications realm, it's all these ways that you can help people in their mobile lifestyle stay connected and solve problems that they have. Digital chocolate, obviously, the idea there is that applications need to be bite-sized. There are moments of indulgence, but sometimes it's really more like digital aspirin. We have a product called the Babysitter, where the entire point of the product is to help a very small child get over a meltdown. And it creates a meaningful social connection between the parent and the child if you can help your child. And if you're in a public situation where your child is out of control, it's bothering other people. So again, there's all these social implications about how the device gets used.
Absolutely. And also, what you've also managed to do is alter the interface. Obviously with games you have a little bit more room to play around with interface than some of the traditional apps. Trying to use email on your cell phone, even some of the more PDA-like smartphones, it's still an experience and a half. If you expect exactly the same, the same sort of richness of data that you do on your desktop. So user interface is a huge deal as well that you've, as I said, managed to play with games. Whereas the user interface on phones hasn't changed a tremendous amount. It's got colorful and ringtones and things.
There's a bit of an identity crisis going on because the handset manufacturers and the carriers haven't quite recognized how they need to change the experience to accommodate the new applications. For example, they're all insistent on having a button right in the face that terminates a phone call, but also blows up whatever's in memory. And it's just far too easy to hit that by accident. Another example is that it's very difficult. A lot of people, in fact, probably don't even know how to change their backlight to remain on, which is something you need for an application, or to adjust the difference between the sound coming out this speaker, which all of us would think of as a speaker, but the phone company refers to it as the ringer. And similarly, separately, they program the sound that is made when you press the keypad, and if you want to adjust that, that's a different setting. And of course, if you haven't got these set exactly correctly, for example, if you're in a public place and you've politely turned off your ringer because you're in a movie theater, but then you want to play a game or do something else, well, you launch that application and the system sound is off and there's nothing you can do about it because you turned off your ringer. So there's a whole bunch of issues like that that everything can be straightened out. And similarly, the carriers, they worry about issues of navigation, because if you're going to try to pull down a huge variety of applications over the air, how much navigation are you going to have to wade through? And again, that's where the paradigm about the web has to be thought about very differently. The consumer is going to be much more transactions-oriented when they use a mobile handset.
You've had a lot of experience with interface building. How do you think interface is going to change on the phone? Do you think that we're going to be pretty much stuck with this as we are right now, or is there some way we can do something that's a tween, to borrow from Flash, that is sort of more focused on the phone but still has some of the interactability of the desktop?
Well, one of the areas where the phone differs a lot from the PC is that the phone is rather static from a UI point of view after you bought it, whereas a PC you can sort of modify.
Well, it doesn't have to be.
That's right. That's changing,
though. Companies like Wildseed that are making plastic skins that go onto the phone that change the physical UI by adding gaming controls, but also at the same time bring content to it that doesn't have to be downloaded in terms of music or video content, and also automatically adjust user interface settings like the color or the backlight settings. So I think there's possibility
that's
on
definitely
the hardware
gonna, side. That's definitely in the process of happening on the phones as well. There's a great battle right now between the handset manufacturers and the operators on who is going to own that user interface. You know, a lot of the top 10 operators are starting to specify very, very specifically what the UI looks like. You take a company like Docomo, where they've gone so far that the handset manufacturer doesn't even get to put their own brand on the device itself. And that's starting to happen with people Orange and Vodafone as well. So we're going to see this battle happening. What I think will happen in the end is that it will actually be the end users who design what UI they want. One of the things we're doing, of course, at Macromedia is putting Flash on phones, and we're starting to see over the next couple of years there will be hundreds of millions of phones with Flash on that will enable a whole new industry of UIs to be actually to be uploaded, to be provisioned, as we call it in the industry, post-purchase up to the device. I think that's going to really put the users in charge again. Because certainly I don't necessarily think that my handset manufacturer or my operator knows exactly what UI I want.
Absolutely. Go ahead, Russell.
No, I was going to say that I think that I'm not really sure what the end result is going to be, but there's definitely the thing about mobile phones to really understand, I think, is that they are the ultimate consumer product. They are not a techie product. They're not something that is in only techies' hands. They're in your mother-in-law's hands. They're in your kid's hands. And they need to have an interface that's more similar to, like, iPod in terms of the ability of just, you know, I've written about this on my weblog that, you know, I've written about this phone and I've written about different ways you can use it in this type of operating system. And I've gotten lots of questions and lots of emails. And I've also written about my iPod, and I've never gotten one person email me and say, how do I use my iPod? There needs to be a level of ease of use that just, we're not there yet. But I think that's an opportunity. Again, I think that, you know, what we're all here for is to sort of look forward and say, what are the opportunities for the mobile space? Well, that's definitely one of them, is to try to figure out what is, you know, the real user interface and how do people actually use their phones. I mean, in the U.S., I always give examples of, you know, waiting for your oil to change. You know, you've got 15, 20 minutes, you're sitting there, you're going to use your phone then, or you're in the airport and you've got a half hour to wait to board and you want to use your device then. And again, it goes back to the BlackBerry users. They really understand that you take it out and you've got that instant on connection. You're interacting with your data and it's great user experience. You know, in other countries, it's more of public transport. Where I lived in Spain for 4 years and you couldn't get on the phone on the bus. Or the metro, and every third person has their mobile phone out in there, and they're sending SMSs and receiving SMSs. And to go back to the user interface, SMS is a classic example of an incredible user interface. And I make the comparison with Google. Google and SMS are similar because they both have one field to fill out. You go to an SMS, and you need to enter in a phone number maybe, but basically you have this big box, and you enter in 150 characters, and you're done. And you hit a button and it sends. And Google's the same way. You go to the Google site, there's one field. There's not a lot of confusion there. And that's why SMS has been so successful, even though that you know, it seems like such a limited technology. It's so easy to use. My 65-year-old mother-in-law in Spain knows how to receive and send SMSs. That level of ubiquity is just something that we serve. The point is that SMS is so ubiquitous and it changes everything when everyone you know has a phone, 80, 90% of the population, and they're sending SMSs and receiving SMSs. It changes culture as we know it.
Absolutely. It's interesting because one of the things that I noticed, a little toy I found for the Macintosh is called Quicksilver, and it's a little application that allows you to quickly type on the keyboard to get to anywhere, to launch applications, to find people to address messages, to play tunes and so forth. And somebody pointed out it was an iPod interface to your Macintosh. It was this nice little feedback system where you could get to anywhere on your Macintosh just by, you know, scrolling forward and backward and touching a few keys. And I wonder if are you taking some of that into account, some of the interface lessons you're learning from the current phones when doing something like the Oqua, where you're trying to, I mean, you know, you're bringing your big laptop into a small space.
Yeah, there aren't that many interface lessons from the phones that I would want to take away. where they are right now. I think, I mean, Quicksilver is an interesting example and one that I would say is more relevant to people thinking about how to have really minimal user interfaces that get you somewhere faster without you having to know exactly how and where to get there. And I think, and probably more so than kind of other success stories like the iPod, which rely on extremely well thought out, purpose-built hardware interfaces. And the thing that I keep thinking about in this context, even aside from the fact that we sell PCs in the pocket and not phones in the pocket, right, is the idea that it's not clear to me who's going to be able to do all the innovation on the application and the content and the UI side, because in the PC, the fact that anyone, that it was an open platform, anyone could develop an application for it, and then with the web, absolutely anyone, including your 65-year-old grandmother probably, can develop, can put up a blog or a web page, that ability to kind of to experiment and create with just, you know, hundreds of millions of content producers is very different than what I currently see on the phone in a way that doesn't make me want to tear down the phone, but makes me want to understand, you know, how is that going to change? How is it going to be because Flash makes it to the web, and so Dreamweaver are going to solve the problem somehow? I'm not certain where that's coming from.
I think that there's lots of opportunities in terms of development. There's 300 million J2ME clients out there now. They have different levels of ability, and I can tell you from experience that developing for J2ME is a challenge. You've got smartphones like the Symbian devices that are going to very soon have Flash on them, and there's Docomo phones that have Flash on them as well, and Java applets. And there's also the fact that, and this is what we were talking about before the session, that I'm a big believer in XHTMLMP, which is a mobile profile of XHTML, which is the next generation of the web. Every mobile phone that's being shipped pretty much from now on is going to have XHTML on the phone. And it can be limited in a variety of ways. Motorola phones only allow, say, 4K of page size, so it becomes very difficult to sort of present things. But the fact is you have the ability to put images, and you have the ability to do some formatting, and it becomes a much more compelling experience. And that's a platform that's as good as the browser, right? It has to be oriented for the mobile phone. Up until now, we've sort of had WML, we've had sort of different types of formats, but I think now we're sort of coalescing on this new phone. And the important thing
Why? Because it seems like if you're talking just a few years into the future, right? So right now we can fit a complete Windows laptop into this form factor. And why won't you just put that into the phone form factor, putting aside even the user interface? Mm-hmm. You dock your phone at your desk, and you have everything and all the computing power and all the applications, and it's just a matter of someone writing a Windows application or some kind of browser plugin for the appropriate phone user hardware interface.
Yeah, I think there's an interesting discussion here, because within 2 years there'll be 1.8 billion subscribers worldwide, 1.8 billion people using mobile phones. So I doubt that one form factor and one solution is the right one. I hate to be trite and say we're all right up here, but you know there will be people who will prefer different devices. As a matter of fact, I think that there's, rather than a digital convergence going on, there's actually a digital divergence going on, in that people will use different devices that are fit for purpose for different needs. I see a lot of BlackBerry users carrying around a mobile phone as well. Partly because they don't want to look silly holding the BlackBerry up, but also because a fit-for-purpose mobile phone tends to be a better mobile phone than the BlackBerry, technically. So there'll be different content authored for different devices. I think there'll be lots of big clusters of devices out there. I think we're going to continue to see a lot of innovation like you guys are doing with the PC, but we're also going to see stuff with much smaller screens and stuff that's built into watches and what have we.
I think the inflection point for me is the point at which you can have your data on your PC and your data, and you can pick up your phone or your BlackBerry or whatever and walk away with some semblance of that data, some piece of it, taking it with you, whether it's your desktop itself, just unplugging and walking off, or it's your cell phone or walking around with a BlackBerry or a Sidekick and having your email with you. There's some semblance you can take along with you.
You're missing a key point here. This is a classic example of a disruptive product. And I remember 25 years ago listening to corporate MIS departments explain to me why their organizations, their Fortune 500 companies, didn't need the PC. But PCs have dramatically outnumbered mainframes. Similarly, computers in this form factor that are thought of by the public as a phone, which is a mission-critical thing, are going to outnumber bigger, beefier devices at least 10 to 1. They're outnumbering 10 to 1 today. You know, today the ratio is 200 million to 20 million. In another 3 years, it'll be 2 billion to 200 million. Not to say that they're not both important markets and aren't growing fast, but all you technology people, get over it. It's not about the technology. It's about the ubiquity. And it's more important to recognize what the limitations are and deal with the limitations. That's what disruptive media are all about. But it's a beautiful thing that there are going to be billions of people carrying these. What I like to say is that to heck with the enterprise market, I'd rather go after the enterprising mothers. There's going to be close to a billion of them carrying these in a few years.
Yeah, one of my favorite applications actually is Dodgeball for SMS, which allows if you're a parent of small children, being able to actually arrange and put on your calendar a meetup anywhere is virtually impossible. Getting out the door is impossible.
That's so a perfect example.
Yeah, exactly. So using Dodgeball, where you say, you know something, we'll just dodgeball each other tomorrow and figure out roughly where we are in town, and there's an SMS sent out saying, hey, I'm near this corner and that corner, and you guys seem to be nearby. Let's meet up now. Completely changed the you said, the sort of soccer mom way of meeting up.
In that case, you're citing the LBS capability of a mobile handset, which is a unique feature of the medium.
I'd like to augment the fact that the ubiquity with the fact there's about 700 million internet users, right? And everyone talks about the scale and everything about that. The problem is those are users. When you talk about the 1.5 billion cellular customers out there, every single person with a cell phone pays a monthly bill of some sort for that cell phone. Those are 1.5 billion customers. 700 million internet users may or may not pay. They may be using the university, maybe at work or whatever. The fact is that each one of those cell phone customers is willing to pay a little bit more for data services and things like that. And that's something that may not be happening in the internet world.
And they have a credit card on file. Which is a huge deal. I mean, back in the ISP days, there were all sorts of talks about the ISP has a credit card, therefore you can start selling and doing micropayments on the net and so forth. I mean, people are spending more money on a ringtone than they pay for a full song. It's rather shocking that you really do consider that those quick and dirty purchases are micropayments are actually happening on the phone. That point. So that's great. Another aspect I can think about, and it's to your point too, is that we keep talking about. I'm really interested in this whole smart task concept of nanotech. But I'm interested on the sort of the macro scale, right? You've got all these people walking around with mobile sensors in their pockets. I mean, camera phones are changing the way that we interact as well. We are effectively at this point little bits of smart dust floating around and blogging and sending messages to one another and so forth. And that is really changing the landscape of, again, how we interact. We're not, you know, even Wi-Fi didn't solve the last few feet problem of just getting you to wherever you are and being able to communicate. You're going a little further than that and taking the actual laptop with you. How do you think you're going to be able to tap into that smart dust?
I mean, I think the camera is a good example, mm-hmm. and where I think you want to rely on the user to tap into it. Right, the people don't seem to have any difficulty using the camera and sending that information around. Right, they're very aggressive about. You know, I'm certainly able to see the large volume of camera phone output sent to me somehow out of the phone by people who otherwise would have trouble with the phone interface. So I think when people are interested in an application, they'll make it work. Yeah.
So we are just about out of time. We want to do some Q&A. There are microphones there.
Actually,
and there.
I just want to give you an example.
Sure.
Of what
if you want to get to the microphones in the meantime.
Which is the fact that there are companies now that are gathering all the LBS information in order to do traffic prediction. And that's an example of what I mean by more of a mobile web application, because I don't want to go do a lot of surfing around to try to figure out what the traffic is. I just want to be able to say, what's the problem? And the application should figure out where I am and consult with all that smart dust information about where everybody else's mobile phones are and how fast they're moving on different roads and tell me where to go.
And indeed being able to feed back, because some of those traffic systems are not updated. You might have MapQuested something, but it's completely useless if you're stuck in a traffic jam where that road is closed suddenly or whatever, and there's nowhere to update the system and warn people about the same sort of thing. We have a question over here.
Oh, I think he was first.
Oh, I'm sorry. Over.
Okay. After you all.
Yeah.
Hi, Elliot Noss from Two Cows. I heard a bit about, but not enough that I actually get, whether all of you, and I guess especially Tripp, really see the application market you know, as funneling through the carriers, or do you think there'll be a robust kind of independent outside of the carrier application space?
You know, there are plenty of other methods of distribution today, but the public still thinks it's only a phone. So step number one is for the public to look at their menu and go, whoa, what do those buttons do? And next thing you know, they find out that there is a service provided by the carrier, and it's automatically billed to their phone bill. And that is just the easiest way to break in the mass market, and also to have the viral process of users telling each other about it, you know, which is absolutely happening at a breakneck pace. All of the other channels, I think, will take more time to nurture and develop, and as users become more familiar with what is already on their phone, they'll start branching out. So things like SMS short codes in Europe, and, you know, buying things off websites, and of course, you know, as those develop and you get increasing presence of Wi-Fi, I think over the next 5 years, this goes from a very carrier-centric channel of distribution to one that is really more like the wireless internet.
So you're going to drive your stuff through carriers whenever possible?
Yeah, at the moment, absolutely, yeah. And, you know, for the foreseeable future.
Okay. But I'll just add to that there are simply too many permutations. If you look at all the developers out there and all the consumers, everyone can't be buying from everyone. So there's a need for some level of aggregation in between. And I don't see anything wrong with the carrier actually being that aggregation point. I think it's very convenient that they know how to bill people, and they know how to bill people a different amount each month, and they know how to do credit control. That's tremendously interesting, and I see a lot of developers salivating over the prospects of being able to register their application with a carrier and have that application go out straight to the subscriber.
Over there?
Hi, I'm Jeff Jarvis at BuzzMachine.com. And Doc Searles, I don't know if he's here yet. He was coming. Doc Searles, the blogger and Linux god, said something on his podcast that was on Adam Curry's podcast being radio shows created now for the iPod, delivered by RSS, that the iPod is really the platform for the new radio of the future, that if the transistor created the transistor radio and created a new platform for the radio we have today, the podcast of being able to get what I want, when I want, where I want it, and take it with me, is the new medium. So the question to this device is, first, does massive storage capability on these devices, and then second, does ubiquitous broadband anywhere, anytime, change the massive delivery of entertainment and content so that it's more than just a social device, which I think it is, but is it also going to be a major delivery of entertainment and content through both storage and broadband, and not just through cell carriers?
I'll take that because I just blogged about this yesterday, and Adam Curry had it. He read it on his latest podcast. My contention is that I've had a 512 meg MMC card in this already. That's just going to get bigger as it goes along. I've got streaming media on this. I can listen to Marketplace and some other on-demand radio already. I think that the podcast is a very interesting thing, and I'm not going to downplay that because I think it has a lot of buzz. But I think it's sort of I think the iPod and podcasting is sort of a stopgap measure between what we have now and what's going to happen very soon. In the Bay Area and other cities in the U.S., AT&T has launched UMTS data, which is 200 kilobits per second down, which is like 32K of data a second. And that's more than enough to stream media. And I don't see a reason why people would have to, you know, put their, you know, iPod in their you know, connected to their phone, and then, like, you know, overnight it downloads stuff, and then they go out and they can listen to it later. When on demand, they can just decide what they want to listen to and click a button and have that streaming media. That stuff is coming, and I think that in the very future that I'm maybe a little bit opposite of you. I think that convergence is definitely coming. I think this is already my camera. I take videos of my little kid with this. I do everything in the world with it. I also listen to MP3s. These phones are becoming so much more powerful. I sort of see that fitting there.
But you're not like most people.
Yes, that's true.
I think it's safe to say that most of us are not like most people running around with these devices. Again, you know, it's I actually really like Tripp's message here, and that is it's about our mothers and friends and so forth who don't carry around every device under the sun and who just really do view this as a phone and are nicely surprised when it's more than that and being able to pass them.
But iPods only sold 4 million iPods, and this has sold over 12 million devices. So there's definitely a divergence between those two categories. I mean, there's an argument to say that this is more popular than iPods.
There's more phones sold every 4 days than there's ever been iPods sold.
Exactly.
So one of my favorite stats that I ran into, I don't actually have a source for it, but was that the number one maker of digital cameras in the UK is Nokia, which was kind of interesting. I mean, everybody knew that was going to happen, but still. Anyway, we have to wrap it up. I'm getting the... thank you very much to all my panelists. And thank you.
You've been listening to a recorded presentation from the Web 2.0 conference held in San Francisco, California, October 5th through 7th, 2004. I'd like to thank Media Live International and O'Reilly Media for the privilege of bringing this session to you today. My name is Doug Kay, and I hope you'll join me next time for another edition of IT Conversations.